Weetalonga, written by Copper Badge, read by Twilight.
Rufus Attius Ferox remembers two childhoods. Yeah, Rory is a girl's name, Jeff taunts, kicking a clod of dirt at Rory's heels. There's no real point in protesting. It only gives Jeff the satisfaction he wants, and Rory can't actually deny that it is, in fact, a girly kind of name. He still clenches his fists at his side, thin arms trembling, weedy 10-year-old body taut with fury and shame. It's always like this, it seems. His whole childhood has felt as if it were built on a bedrock of hostility. The world hates him, but not really enough to do anything drastic. It just sends bullies to make him angry and stupid grown-ups to stand by impotently and remind him there will never be anything he can do about it. "Don't listen to that wanker," Amy says, putting an arm around his shoulders. "Rory hangs out with girls," Jeff calls, but his voice is receding in the distance. He's got to wait for his stupid mates, but Rory and Amy don't have to wait for anything. Amy and her aunt have struck a wary truce. As long as she goes to the therapist every week, the rest of her afternoons are her own. It's not logical. Rory knows that already. It means Amy's aunt is simply going through the motions. But it also means that 4 glorious days out of 5, he and Amy can bolt for the edge of the village and play pretend out where nobody will see them. It is very important to Rory that nobody sees them, because he already knows they are well past the age for playing pretend, really. "I made up a new story," Amy says, as she climbs up into the big oak and fetches down their play box. "Not Raggedy Doctor again," Rory groans, but secretly he's pleased. Amy comes up with the best stories, and lately, sometimes, he gets to kiss her at the end, even if she's not really kissing him. It sends a thrill up Rory's spine, a promise of more grown-up pastimes he's seen on telly. Amy knows his weakness. "If we don't play Raggedy Doctor, you don't get the sonic screwdriver." Rory loves the sonic screwdriver, like he loves ice cream and dissecting things in science class. It's just a pen light, but Amy's decorated it with bits of wire and little levers and sparkly things. When he waves it around and shazams and beezzes things with it, he feels like a king. Jeff can never, ever, ever know about the sonic screwdriver. Rory harbors suspicions it might be kind of gay. So he changes his school uniform for a battered, too big Oxford he stole from his dad's closet. That was a mission Amy sent him on, like a spy. And a pre-ripped pair of trousers. Amy passes him the rattiest of his school ties to knot around his throat, and then she lets him have the sonic screwdriver. He's a really proper Raggedy Doctor now. "Is it aliens or monsters or what this time?" he asks. "Giant man-eating plants!" Amy shouts, pointing at the shrubbery in the distance. Rory takes a brief second to declare that, scientifically, giant man-eating plants are rubbish, and then runs after her as she dashes off to do battle with Ledworth's untamed landscape. Rufus remembers a childhood of McDonald's and flush toilets and cars, science classes, bullies, and the fact that he wasn't the town freak only because nobody could out-freak Amy. At least, not in Ledworth. Ledworth was the town. His name was Rory Williams. The men still call him Rory, an unofficial agnomen, a nickname. His father will be pleased when he hears Rufus is so popular. He remembers two fathers, but the more vivid of them is Brutus Attius Africanus, the consul. As a boy, he ran barefoot on the tiled ground of his father's villa's courtyard, the only cool place in the summer, and stole sweet fruit right off the trees. Rufus! His mother calls, and Rufus dodges around the courtyard fountains, ducking under the spray quickly to cool down. He arrives in front of his mother, breathless and damp, shaking water out of his hair, beaming. She looks disapproving. Salve, Rufus Attius, says Julia Sea, his mother's best friend, which means, his heart jumps a little in his throat, that Camilla Pontia might be there. Salve, Domina Sae, he says politely, with a little bow. Salve, Camulaulus, he calls, because he can see Camilla in the portico. You are not to distract Camilla today, his mother tells him, as Camilla Pontia runs past her aunt to greet Rufus properly. It's high time she began behaving more like a lady, Iulia Sea agrees, and Camilla rolls her eyes. She fascinates Rufus. Born and brought up in a wild, occupied territory across the sea, she's as close as you can get to a princess in Rome, and yet she doesn't act like any of the girls Rufus knows. He's heard his mother and Camilla's aunt talking. He knows that Camilla is meant for him when they're grown. A very good match! And he hopes when he's a little more height on him, she'll stop treating him like a favored plaything and start acknowledging his inherent male superiority. Still, better Camilla Pontia's plaything than any other woman's dominus. He waits by his mother's chambers, just outside the door, listening as they talk and drink watered wine until both his mother and Julius Sea have drowsed off to sleep. Camilla has been watching, too. When he whistles through his teeth softly, she creeps out the door, and then they're free. His oratory tutor, a young Greek slave his father bought for him a year ago, has set loads and loads of recitation to memorize, so he and Camilla spend the afternoon lost in poetry and rhetoric, strutting among the servants as they wash the clothes and sweep the floors. Father has workmen in to do a new mosaic on the western wall, and they sit on the fountain, drumming their heels, getting wet as they watch two artisans labor under the stern eye of a master. So far, the mosaic shows half of a feast, lanterns hanging in the corners. The lanterns are blue and boxy, and give yellow light from their little shutters. Salve, Camulaulus! His father's voice booms through the courtyard, and then he's sweeping down on them in his glorious white toga, wrapping Camilla in a hug and cuffing Rufus across the head affectionately. Rufus remembers his father as the biggest, brightest star in the Roman sky, with a sweep of messy dark hair over his forehead. He hated being barbered. And a face that looks too young to be a consul with a half-grown son. He looks like the doctor. Rufus also remembers a childhood that current evidence says he could never have had. He has vivid recollection of a school trip to London to see the tower, and how Amy had bloodthirstily lingered in the armory where they kept the torture devices, while Rory had sought out the room where Lady Jane Grey's husband had carved Aeane in the stone before they were both executed, 550 years before. He remembers studying biology and chemistry for his A-levels. When he thinks about being a young man, he remembers training as a nurse, getting his first job. But when Rufus was a young man, he was sent into the military as an officer.
When they were 14, Rory put his foot down and said it was time to stop playing Raggedy Doctor, time to grow up, and Amy didn't speak to him for a month, during which time she bit her current therapist and drove her aunt nearly to distraction. Rory hasn't ever asked, but he can guess why she bit her therapist, and it's only partly to do with the therapist's insistence that the doctor wasn't real. The rest has to do with some very unorthodox physical contact techniques he had. Amy's aunt had worn out conventional psychotherapy by then. He doesn't actually know what happened, and Amy has always said she got her teeth in before anything did happen. And the point is, whoever he wasn't good for Amy, and good on her for biting him. The day she bit the therapist, she came over to his house and cried on his bed for like an hour, and Rory sat there and didn't know what to do. If she asked him to play Raggedy Doctor with her, he totally would have, just to make her happy. But she never asked again. So he stroked her hair and gave her tissues and tried to be a good friend. He's 16 now, standing in front of a mirror in the same bedroom, studying himself carefully. He's seen enough drawings and dollies to know what the Raggedy Doctor really looks like, and what he's got going now is a sight better than the makeshift stuff from when they were kids. He has very carefully beaten the shit out of his shirt, chopped up a tie he got at Oxfam for a pound, ripped holes in his oldest trousers, and disarrayed his hair as much as one can disarray hair that's less than an inch long. The funny thing is, they're going to a fancy dress party, and the whole town will be there, and everyone will know absolutely what he is. Somehow, Amy's insane delusions have infected Ledworth. And after the biting incident, the town closed ranks around her. Several women from church went round to see her aunt and said if Amy wanted to be crazy, she could jolly well be crazy, and it was time to put a stop to all this therapy nonsense. Rory wonders where the sonic screwdriver ever got to. "Rory, come on, stop preening!" Amy yells from the kitchen. Rory sighs. If he had known what the friend zone was when he was 8, he would never have made friends with her. Being in love with your best friend sucks donkey bollocks. "Coming!" he yells back, clattering down the stairs. He steps into the kitchen and spreads his arms, about to ask, "So what do you think?" when he sees Amy, and his tongue does that thing where it tries to choke him. It's not that Amy's in anything especially revealing. It's some kind of Roman outfit. "Tunica," Rufus supplies helpfully. And it preserves her modesty reasonably well. But her hair's all intricately piled up on her head, and there's, more leg than usual showing. Amy has a lot of leg. Legs? Anyway, she has them, and they're brilliant. Amy's staring at him with big, round eyes. Rory lets his arms fall, realizing what he may have just done, and suddenly unconcerned with Amy's hair and legs and general gloriousness. "You hate it," he says, stomach twisting into knots. "It's insulting. You're angry. Oh, God." "No, no. I like it," she breathes. And then Amy's all way up in his personal space. She fingers a threadbare patch on his collar. "Nice attention to detail." "Yes, well, when destroying clothing, it's important to do it properly," he manages. He steps back and offers her his arm. When they get to the party, Amy gets catcalls. Rory gets laughter. Jeff rolls his eyes and pronounces Rory king of losers. But Jeff's costume is a lame attempt to look like a robot, so it's kind of hard to pull off being judgy. Amy, who is in a kleptomaniac phase,
gets him and Jeff drunk on a bottle of swiped whiskey after the party. Well, and herself too, fair's fair. They sit down under a tree on the commons, and Jeff tells them all about his big plans to ditch Ledworth and go somewhere cool like New York or maybe Berlin. And Amy curls herself up between Rory's legs, head pillowed on his chest, fingers toying with his tie. Rory tries not to let her get too close, because nothing ruins a nice evening like an intrusive erection. She smells so good. Rory thinks that his parents think that Amy's kind of a charity case. Untrue. And he thinks that her aunt is probably just so desperate for Amy to even pretend to be normal that she doesn't care if Amy spends all of her time with Rory. Such a nice, stable boy. God, he's so bitter about being so stable sometimes. But it means that when they stagger off to bed, nobody is going to care that Amy comes over to his, and nobody's going to think it's weird if she's there in the morning. They've done this a million times. He's just got them both up the stairs, giggling and shushing each other, and closed his bedroom door. He's seeing about getting out the trundle bed for Amy when she pulls him back by his shirt collar, spins him around, and shoves her tongue in his mouth. About 5 minutes of, oh God, later, with her hands pushing his shirt up, Rory realizes that he is going to have sex. With Amy, who has had his heart wrapped around her little finger since they were 9 years old. On the one hand, this could very well destroy their friendship and freak them both out and, since he definitely wasn't prepared for this, get Amy pregnant. On the other, he is 16, and sex is the overriding concern of most of his waking moments. Rory's not Casanova or anything, but he spent a lot of time on the internet as a teenager, and through the alcohol-hazed memories of this later, he thinks he did all right. They didn't even get all the way out of their clothes, but Amy's costume was surprisingly easy access, and as she straddled him and sank down, there was really not much for him to do but hold on and try to keep up. He's pretty sure she didn't actually say doctor at one point, that he misheard somehow. Pretty sure. When Rufus went into the military, his father told him, "Be brave and strong and kill a lot of barbarians." That's how he knows his father can't have been the doctor, because the doctor would never say that last bit. And the doctor wouldn't care what Rory was, so long as he was happy. His father, meanwhile, dreamed of Rufus Atius returning a dux, as if he were going to cross the Rubicon like Julius Caesar, alia iacta est, and become the next emperor of Rome. He does love his father and wants to do him proud, and he thinks he has done so as much as he's able. Ferox is his cognomen, warlike, and his men affectionately call him Rory Lagatus. He's well liked by his legion. It is not entirely out of the question that, in due time, he will become dux, leader of many legions. Not like Ledworth, where his father, shorter, quieter, grayer, always looked at his nurse's badge with a little sigh, because he wasn't the doctor they wanted him to be. Rufus Atius's nose isn't funny-looking like Jeff used to say. It's a good patrician nose, a sign of strong breeding. When he returns home from this campaign, he'll be a decorated young statesman, eminently suitable for marriage to Camilla Pontia, Amy Pond, for whom he bought a ring, who said yes, even if she loved the doctor best. Unlike his men, he's nobly born enough that he feels an obligation to be faithful to her,
and he avoids the camp followers and the native girls. Though he doesn't figure a few desperate nights between the thighs of his prettiest centurion really counts. That's practically a legatus's right. A few months after the biting incident, Rory noticed that Jeff's mates all stopped hanging around with him. It wasn't that they turned on him, precisely. They just ruthlessly cut him out of everything they did. Rory watched with a certain vengeful glee, at least until Jeff started hanging around him all the time. Rory and Amy were already the losers of their social set. They couldn't really afford to be seen with the newest loser. Still, he tried to be tolerant and magnanimous or whatever, even though he suspected deep down that Jeff was playing some kind of long game prank on him. And it festered, as these things will, until finally one day Jeff was, there was no other word for it, tagging along with him to the shops when Rory finally snapped. "Just go away, why don't you?" he shouted. "I don't know what you think you're playing at." "I'm not playing at anything," Jeff shouted back. "Who are you, Mr. High and Mighty?" "I'm not here to be the butt of your jokes," Rory snarled, "so you can fuck off." "Make me," Jeff retorted. Words were exchanged, heated words, and challenges thrown down, and all that led to what Rory's father would absently refer to later as the dust-up. Which really meant that Rory and Jeff went for each other in the middle of the high street like rabid dogs. As Rory expected, nobody even tried to pull them apart. He heard one woman say, "I've wanted to see that boy thrash him for years," and hoped, really hoped, he was the purported thrasher and not the thrashee. He didn't precisely thrash Jeff, who was bigger and stronger than him. But as Jeff later admitted, he got his arse handed to him and kept coming back for more. Apparently, this counted for something in the social currency Jeff had been used to. On Rory's part, he had to admit Jeff wouldn't get into that kind of fight unless he was really in earnest about the whole, "I'd like to be your friend, but I'm too much of a moron to say it" thing. So, nursing a black eye and a split lip and a sprained shoulder, Rory met up with Jeff the next day. Jeff did have a shiner of his own and was walking with a limp. And they went to see Amy and have chips and cokes at the cafe. And after that, apparently they were friends. Amy accepted Jeff with a sort of wary indifference, until she ascertained that he didn't want to grab her boobs or pull her hair or be mean to Rory. Then, she looped him into her insanity in the way Amy had, which brooked no opposition. Oddly, Rory remembers what led up to the fight with Jeff much more vividly than he remembers what led up to the sex with him. Depending on your definition, Rory lost his virginity to Amy at 16 while dressed as the raggedy doctor and very, very drunk. In reality, he couldn't deny that there was a certain loss of innocence component to what he got up to with Jeff the summer after he turned 15. He doesn't remember how they ended up kissing, though he does vividly remember his first hand job. And very, very vividly does he remember Jeff's attempt at oral sex, because teeth got unpleasantly involved, and after that they decided maybe they'd stick to hands for now. He and Jeff had a good time for the better part of a year, and he doesn't regret it. Jeff, for one, never imagined him as anything other than himself. Jeff knew about the raggedy doctor, but it's the one thing he'd never teased Rory about, and Rory thinks perhaps that means something. He does feel bad about the way he treated Jeff. In hindsight, it was pretty obvious that Jeff's mates dumped him when they found out he fancied boys. It should have been obvious that he had a crush on Rory, but Rory really didn't see it at the time. He just thought they were messing around, so Rory sort of accidentally dumped him once Amy got involved in the sex. Rory's not proud of that. At the time, he didn't really know what to do, but still. He spent most of his life not knowing what to do. He really likes science, and science doesn't work very well on people. He has regrets. But they grew up, he and Amy and Jeff apparently got over it. Besides, Jeff's the handsome one, and Rory's just that nurse. So even if they were competing for Amy, or for any given boy in the village, it's not like Rory would stand a chance. Amy's so clever and beautiful, he can hardly believe his luck some days. Rufus is kinder to his pet Centaurian than he ever was to the boy in Ledworth. Gaius adores him, but Gaius also knows what their bed sharing is and what it isn't. Rory is waiting for Amy to arrive with her raggedy doctor, Dr. Panosus. Except in Latin, doctor means teacher, and in English, well, Rory isn't sure what it means for the doctor. Gaius doesn't stand a chance against Camilla, his promised wife, or Amy, who he hopes still wears his ring. Well, he hopes she wears it while sitting down or reading or something, and not while out saving the universe because it's bound to get lost. But they both may die before Amy and the doctor show up, if they're going to show up at all. Snatching a bit of pleasure hardly seems criminal, and denying Gaius this one thing would be cruel. They are 20 years old, he and Amy and Jeff, and Jeff's been offered a job with some diplomatic office in London after the business with the doctor turning out to be real. Apparently, Jeff is something of a smooth talker, which Rory has long suspected. Jeff's leaving, and he's getting a flat in London, and Amy has seemed envious, which is why Rory is taking desperate measures. Things changed after the raggedy doctor came back and then left again. The people of Ledworth seemed determined to forget the giant flying eyeballs. But when Amy passes by, there's no longer any hint of pity or sympathy in their faces. Amy's stories are real, and somehow that gives her power. She could make up a story about any of them, and would it come true? So maybe now, in place of pity, there's a bit of fear. Amy doesn't seem to notice, but Amy stopped caring what people thought of her when she was a child. Rory perhaps cares a little too much still, but when it comes to Amy, he has no pride. "Will you marry me?" he says in the mirror, studying his face to make sure he doesn't look stupid. "I want you to marry me. I want to be your husband." Oh, bollocks. "Don't say you want to be her husband. That sounds moronic," Jeff advises. "This is all your fault," Rory announces. "My fault?" Jeff looks outraged. "Yes, your stupid bloody fault. You had to be all, 'Ooh, I'm going to London. Ooh, I'm going to have a flat. Why don't you come visit me?'" Rory waved his hands around, aware that now he definitely looks stupid. What if Amy wants to move to London? Now she's got a beachhead. "Okay, what did you just call me?" Jeff asks, standing up. It's been 6 years since Jeff stopped being Rory's most hated enemy, and 5 years since Jeff was maybe kind of his boyfriend for a bit. And they've been best mates for ages, so Rory's not exactly afraid Jeff's going to punch him. He rolls his eyes. "A beachhead. You know, a foot in the door. If she wanted to up sticks and run off to London, she's got a mate there to show her around and let her sleep on his couch, and I bet kissograms make way better money in London than they do in Ledworth. Rory tries really hard not to be angry about Amy's kissogramming. It's her life, she can do what she wants, and he's being an insecure twit. But it hurts to think about her kissing someone else. Nurses do too, Jeff points out, turning him back to face the mirror. He rests his hands on Rory's shoulders, thumbs rubbing smoothingly along his neck, smiling at Rory in their reflection. You and Amy could both come with me. Promise to be the perfect gentleman. Rory thinks men probably don't do this. Straight men, anyway. Men who are going to ask women to marry them in a few hours. He doesn't care. He leans back against Jeff a little bit, taking comfort from touch that has long since become platonic, if perhaps a bit more intimate than most friends share. Jeff squeezes his shoulders, taking his weight without even seeming to notice. She loves you, Jeff tells him. I love you. Not like that, he adds when Rory tenses. Wow, get over yourself. I'm trying to be the supportive friend here. You suck at it, Rory tells him. It's Jeff's turn to roll his eyes. Don't you even make a joke about sucking. Fine, whatever. Jeff gives him a slight shove and lets him go. She'll say yes. What if the doctor comes back? Rory asks, which is really his greatest fear. Then I have dibs, Jeff announces. It's nothing fancy, really. Rory wears his nicest shirt, but they just go out for pizza at the Italian place and then for a walk near the oak where they used to hide their play box. He doesn't even get down on one knee because Amy doesn't like that kind of fairy story. He just stands there under the oak and holds her hands in both of his and says, I love you, and I want you to marry me. So, do you think you want to marry me? Amy seems to be deciding something. Actually, she seems to be listening for something. As if she can still hear their shrieks of terror and laughter when they were kids playing Raggedy Doctor. Then she says yes, and that's all that matters. Rory would do anything for Amy. He can fix up her aunt's old house for her, or maybe if she wants a different house, they can buy one together. He'll buy her the prettiest wedding dress, whatever she wants. If she wants children, they'll have loads, or if she wants, like, maybe some dogs instead. He likes dogs, or even cats, though he's not that fond of cats. If she wants to go to London, he'll totally go to London with her. As long as he gets to be with her, he'd go to the moon. Or, as it turns out, to Venice during the Renaissance. Funny how these things happen. Rory has had his own thoughts and dreams, and he knows Amy does too. He loves her, and he thinks she loves him, but neither is the other's whole world. Amy's imagination is too big for one person, and Rory has too much love for only her. Still, he would happily die for Amy if he had to. He always thought if her doctor made her happy, he'd die for him too. But he never imagined he would die for the doctor, because the doctor is worth dying for. Rory loves the doctor, too. Which really is the whole used to hate Jeff, but now there's hand jobs thing all over again. Except without the hand jobs. So far, anyway. Rufus learned his historical poets as a child. He likes most of Horace. Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori has meaning for his soldiers too, but only as a dusty bit of poetry from 100 years ago. Horace meant it sincerely. Rory, even as a soldier ferox, finds it mocking. To him, It is the sharp-tongued conclusion of a poem about the brutality of soldiering that he had to memorize when he was 12. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est. It is sweet and dignified to die for the patria, the land of one's fathers. If Rufus dies, he will receive an honorable funeral, with an actor in a wax mask of his face riding a litter through the streets of Rome to ensure his immortality and to glorify his deeds. But all the same, he'd rather not die. Not yet, thank you. His life is a mystery. He remembers Ledworth, even as he gives orders to his men in drawling Latin he never learned at Ledworth schools. Plum pretium, it would be in Latin. He asked one of the cartographers in the Legion about Plum pretium, if ever there was a town called that, and was told they'd never mapped such a place. He remembers Latin from the other life. Elizabeth II Regina. Semper ubi sub ubi. Nil illigatomo cobrundum. None of them with any meaning in this time, in this place, since translingual puns don't work when English hasn't been invented yet. Fabricati diem punk is downright absurd. Oh, he misses Terry Pratchett novels. Amy had her escapes, he had his own. Each morning, Rory puts on his tunica, his baltus, his lorica musculata and paludamentum, his brachii if it's cold, and he thinks about his light, loose scrubs, and his sensible trainers and his boxer briefs. Oh, how he misses boxer briefs! Semper ubi sub ubi, indeed. Some mornings, Rory the Ferox leads a few hundred men into battle if he must. He often comes quite close to dying. Some other mornings, better mornings, he takes a few contubernii and goes to trade and make treaties. Ferox he may be, but he is not Atrox, and he does prefer peace to war. Most mornings, he wonders if today will be the day he wakes up in the TARDIS again, but he never does. Look, even Rory knows that Cleopatra is dead by 102 AD, and it's not like history was his strongest subject. If he hadn't been out on maneuvers with his men when she showed up, he would have marched in and drummed her out of camp. But by the time he gets back, his dux had returned and already knows Cleopatra is dead. At least someone's not a moron around this place. More intriguing, there are rumors that Cleopatra took three horses and rode out to that creepy temple on the plain. Stonehenge. He read a comic book once about Stonehenge in that other life. And with her went a skinny, dark-haired man they say is Caesar. Liars! The doctor is greater than the greatest Caesar who ever marched for Rome. And a red-headed woman. Probably his concubine or something. The first man to call her a concubine in his hearing gets knocked on his ass by Rory Lagatus, the Ferox. And nobody's quite sure why. It's not like the Ferox has ever been particularly patriotic about their emperor. He volunteers to go with the woman who calls herself Cleopatra. The rest of the camp thinks she's a witch, but the forced respect for their legatus is strong enough for 8 contubernii to decide they're going with him. 48 men, plus Rory and his centurion, Gaius, march in good formation across Salisbury Plain to the temple, and then underneath it. Rory's pretty impressed with himself, the way he killed that robot thing. His heart leapt when he saw Amy, his Amy, his Kamulalus. And to his surprise, it leapt again when the doctor appeared. For a horrible second, the doctor didn't seem to know him. But then he called him Rory, and Rory realized the doctor was just having a very stupid moment. He has those sometimes. It's endearing. As the doctor rants and wanders around, Rory wishes he'd polished his lorica and maybe washed his paludamentum. Fortunately for him, at least, Amy really likes Romans. Really, really likes them. Almost as much as she likes the Raggedy Doctor. Rory wonders if there will be an appropriate time to ask the doctor if maybe his boxer briefs are still in the TARDIS. Seriously, fuck the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Towels are no substitute for comfortable underwear. Rufus Attius Ferox, Rory Legatus, is quite a mouthful of a name. And it's not, well, it's not real. He has no father and mother waiting for him in Rome, no Camilla, no lovely courtyard with its mural of feasters lit by blue lanterns. When he returns to Rome as part of the guard on the Pandorica, none of his life has been real. He is a plastic man, a dolly, like the dollies Amy used to make of the doctor. But he remembers Rufus, and he feels like Rory. He punched the doctor to prove he was Rory once, just like he went after Jeff to prove his manhood at the tender age of 14. His immortality is a whispered legend among the keepers of the Pandorica, though he is irrationally angry when the barbarians who eventually capture it demote him in their stories to a mere centurion. Various kings and guards and soldiers, a few archaeologists and some scientists, have all tried to take the box from him, or take him from the box. They didn't have much success. His name was Rufus Attius Ferox, after all. He fought well, and frankly, despite the doctor's warnings, it turned out Nestines were pretty durable. He has a few holes here and there, and one of his toes fell off at one point. But if that's all he has to complain about, he's doing all right. He thinks he's still sane. The thing is, it's all down to maths. And Rory's rather good at maths. Time doesn't actually speed up when you get older, but it does seem to. Because, right, when you're 5, a year is a fifth of your whole life, and that's forever. But when you're 25, a year is only 1/25th, and that's not very long at all. The first 10 years were pretty boring, but he got through them okay. The next 20 were like the last hour of a really, really long car ride, when it's late and you're all cramped and hot and cranky. He did cut off someone's arm when they tried to touch the Pandorica at some point in those 20 years. He's not actually proud of that. The next 30 went pretty quickly, though, and the 60 after that, he doesn't even remember except as a big blur. The next real memory he has is when the Franks took the Pandorica, and they left him alone, mostly. The Knights Templar were quite nice, too, but then they gave him and the Pandorica to the Vatican. All that chanting, it really does grate on a man after a while. Plus, they wanted to burn him at the stake, and he had to do some very fast talking to convince them he was an angel of the Lord and they should fear for their puny mortal lives. After that, time passed pretty quickly, and he has no real complaints. He did stay in uniform as long as it was practical to do so, but eventually people looked at him and saw the centurion. Legatus, seriously, how hard can it be? Whether he was in the Iorca or not, so he got into something a little more contemporary. Plus, by 1200 or so, it was hard to find a good, durable Iorca. In 1939, this soldier came to visit him. For the first time in almost 2,000 years, instead of shouting or gesturing or threatening, he sat down and lit a cigarette and said, "So, mate, what's your story then?" Rory looked at him. He generally stuck to a policy of only speaking Latin because it seemed to confuse them into leaving him alone. "Lingua mia dices?" The man grinned. "Nay, dico, English dices?" "I thought you said you didn't speak Latin," Rory replied, startled into English. "Nay, dico, quod discipulis caleris sum," the soldier said smugly. Rory laughed for the first time in ages. "That's not right, you know." "Yeah, I know. I didn't say I was a good student," the soldier said. "So you do speak English. Well, that wins me too, Bob." "Glad I could help," Rory told him, expecting him to bugger off back to the guardhouse outside the archive where the Pandorica was kept. Instead, the man took another drag of his smoke. "Must get kind of boring," he said. "Has its moments," Rory replied. "Do a lot of thinking?" Rory snorted. "Yeah, a lot." "You want a book or something? I could take over for a minute while you visit the loo." Rory didn't have his sword anymore, but he had picked up a revolver the last time the Pandorica changed hands, mostly for show, and now he cocked it. The soldier held up his arms placatingly. "It's all right, mate. I'm not interested in your box," he said. Rory relaxed slightly. "Just thought, you know, you might want to have a stretch or something." Rory leaned forward and put his chin in his hands, resting his elbows on his knees. "Have they invented boxer briefs yet?" he asked plaintively. The soldier frowned. "What are those when they're at home?" Rory had to do him a description eventually, but the next day, a cheap pasteboard box with two pairs of boxer briefs were delivered. Compliments of His Majesty's government. They were a bit scratchy and not very stretchy, but Rory put them on and then did up his trousers and walked around for like half an hour, enjoying the sensation. Oh, lovely. They were clearly in the home stretch now, and the only direction to go from here was up. Rory Williams remembers so many lives. Never when he's awake. When he's awake, he's just Rory. But sometimes he dreams about a courtyard in Rome, or a battlefield in some misty, freezing place. Or years upon years upon years of patience. He dreams about a blue box with a man in it, and he can't decide whether he loves or hates him. He dreams about being places with Amy that they've never been, that they never could go. He dreams about Jeff leaving Ledworth, though Jeff's going to be the best man at his wedding. He blames Amy. Well, not blames her. It's not her fault. But he credits his vivid dreamscapes to her waking imagination. Clearly, being bonkers is contagious. So when it all comes rushing back, when the blue box actually shows up at their wedding and there's this bloke inside it in a white tie and tails and it's the doctor, Rory hears himself say,
I was plastic. He was the stripper at my stag do. And then he jumps over the table after Amy. The doctor is glorious. He's alive, and he's making fun of Amy, and then he calls Rory Mr. Pond. Even as Rory's protesting that, his insides twist with pleasure, partly at being marked as Amy's forever, and partly because the doctor's hand is warm on his arm through his suit. "There's only one thing for it," Amy says that night as they're dancing the last dance and both heavily aware that the doctor is slipping away. Rory nods against her forehead. "We have to go with him." "Yep," she says. "What do we need? Should we pack?" he asks. "Got your ring on, Mr. Pond?" Amy replies. Rory holds up his left hand so she can see it. "Come on, then," she tells him, and they kiss and slip away into the night, half a minute behind the doctor. He was worried they'd have to convince the doctor to take them along, but it turns out the doctor's been plotting to convince them, so they don't even have to try. And, well, the TARDIS really wasn't where Rory expected to spend his wedding night, but he didn't remember the TARDIS that morning, and he and Amy have been shagging since they were 16, so it doesn't really matter. Under the amber lights of the control room, Amy and the doctor both glow like there's some kind of holy light coming off them. The doctor looks at him and looks at Amy and says, "This might take a while, you know. You two should get some rest." Rory grins at him. Amy squeals and throws her arms around Rory's neck. "Wedding night," she announces. "That was the general idea," Rory drawls, but the effect is ruined when he almost stumbles as she pulls him towards the stairs. They run together down the hall and around the corner to where their room is waiting for them. The TARDIS purrs beneath their feet. "Domina," echoes in his mind from Rory's days as Rufus, mistress of the household, queen of him and of the TARDIS and of the doctor. They do rest for a while after sex, the best kind of happy, love you, let's get messy sex, deliberately not caring whether the TARDIS has landed or not. Rory drowses in the perpetual twilight of the blue room they share and the softness of their bed. After a while, Amy turns in his arms and touches his chest over his heart. "I love you," she says. Rory can barely breathe. "I love you too," he answers. "I fancy you rotten." "Well, I figured that was part of the love me deal," he informs her. She swats him gently. "Can I ask, though?" She bites her lip and then continues. "What do you think of him?" "Well, that was an odd and unsettling segue," he says, pushing himself up on one elbow to look down at her. "Are you asking in general or in the fancy him rotten sense?" "Do you fancy him?" Rory strokes her hair with the tip of a finger. "You knew about Jeff and me, didn't you?" "Yep," she replies, smiling. "And you never said anything." "Well, you married me. So, do you?" Rory kisses her forehead. "It's complicated. When I was a Roman, they made the doctor my dad, sort of. And you made me dress up as him when we were kids and vigorously deflowered me while I was dressed like him. So that's a bit weird." "Deflowered you?" she laughs. "And my wife fancies him, which makes it a very tricky situation, you know," he adds. Amy sobers. "But do you?" she repeats. Her fingers brush his wedding ring. Yeah, he admits, because whatever, who cares? They're in the TARDIS, traveling to some train in space, placing their trust and their lives in the hands of an alien who's older than sand and has this weird fixation on bow ties and fezzes. Fezzi? Fezzes? Amy obviously already knew Rory sometimes likes boys, so his sexuality is the very least of his concerns right now. I'm glad, Amy says, and there's a fierce light in her eyes. What do we do? Rory asks. He doesn't seem the type to, you know. Can he even? I mean, I don't know. He told me once he liked you. A lot, she says. So? He likes custard a lot. Amy laughs. You weren't there. He did the most adorable little head duck thing. And he blushed. He never did. He doesn't blush, Rory exclaims. Does he? He did then. Rory flops down again, pulling Amy close against him. So you fancy him, and I fancy him, and he maybe fancies me, and definitely fancies you. Could make life very interesting, Amy suggests. I'm not sure how much interesting my life can take, Rory sighs. I suppose the worst he can do is leave us on a space train in the future with no money. That's my optimist. Amy kisses his bare shoulder. But the thing is, they kind of leave it there, this half-possibility hanging in the space between them. Neither of them wants to talk about how such a thing might be accomplished, or risk that the doctor might find them two silly, unevolved apes and put them off the TARDIS completely. Rory can't very well ask Amy to handle it, and Amy can't very well tell Rory to handle it. So what he's left with are vague ideas and vaguer curiosities. What would it feel like? What would the doctor do? How does he look freshly kissed? How would it be, really, to see his wife with another man? How would it feel to be with another man while Amy is there? And for all his time with Jeff, it's not like they got very far, really. And his memories of Gaius are cloudy at best. So what exactly would the doctor want with him? If anything. Besides, maybe the doctor doesn't even have any, you know, bits. Or he's got bits in weird places. Or bits with teeth. What a thought. They nap quietly, now that it's out in the open, and Rory wakes with sleep-dry mouth to find the doctor standing in the doorway, knuckles pressed against the frame. He knocks once. Rory can't see his face, but he can tell he's smiling. Almost there, he says quietly. Rory pushes himself up to sitting. Amy complains in her sleep, mildly, but doesn't wake. Good, eh? Rory frowns. More? Good? It's good, you and Amy? The doctor says, but he doesn't wait for a reply. Never had a married couple traveling here before. Well, some of them might as well have been. There was this bloke, Ian, he had chemistry with everything. Robots, doorknobs, inert gases. Took someone like Barbara to really put his brakes on. Hey. Old memories, he adds, drifting in some past time. Funny how I never used to pay attention to that sort of thing. Rory has no clue what to say. This is easier when there's crying involved. Then his job is to stroke hair and fetch tissues. Or, when there's a big box to be guarded. Rory is fucking aces at guarding big boxes. Well, anyway, up and dress, time's wasting, the doctor says, and disappears before Rory can get another word out. And then, see, there's this space train and an alien queen and an Egyptian goddess and lots of running. So until everything goes boom, Rory puts it out of his mind. The boom was pretty spectacular. When all's said and done and blown up, Amy has this thing. She gets really... well, she really likes having adventures, and she likes kissing people after having adventures. As he's there, and married to her, they recover from the explosion and kiss a lot and go back to bed. While she sleeps, Rory lies in bed in the TARDIS with her and thinks really hard about everything that's happened. Not so much with the train, but everything that happened when the stars went out. The way he reckons it, it's part ways about the stars. There's no way that world would have turned out like what he thinks of as the real world if there were no stars. Terry Pratchett, good old P. Terry, is invaluable in the TARDIS, if only for keeping one's sense of humor. Says that when things are supposed to happen, they happen. If you kill someone who was supposed to do something, someone else will do it, just to make sure time more or less stays on track. Still, this stretches credulity. And Rory was there. So Rory formulates a theory, which he calls in his head the "it's all rubbish" theory, that a lot of things that happened didn't actually happen. Like the 2,000 years he waited for Amy, though they seemed real enough to him at the time, per yoam. There is the right world, even if it's wrong, where they grew up playing Raggedy Doctor and he died and came back as a Roman. Then there's the world without stars and the world without the doctor. And Rory decides that both of those really only existed because of Amy. Rory climbs out of bed, slipping away from Amy, and walks to the console room in his pajamas. He has to know if his understanding is even close to being right. He thinks it means that everything they knew about the universe is wrong. That science is good, but science isn't enough. What if reality, physics, biology, chemistry, all of it depends on stories too? That's actual magic. Not sufficiently advanced technology, not different kind of maths, but something bigger and warmer and very much like Amy herself somehow. "Doctor," he calls. The doctor looks up from contemplating a row of green switches on the console. "Hello," the doctor says, smiling at him. "Where's Pond?" "Oh, still sleeping." Rory jerks the thumb over his shoulder as he descends the stairs. The doctor returns to his staring, so Rory stares for a while too. "What do they do?" he finally asks. "Nothing. They're just there to be pretty," the doctor says. He looks perplexed by this. The TARDIS is getting vain in her old age. Rory pats the edge of the console, wondering how aware the TARDIS really is. The doctor talks about it, or her, like she's a person. "I need to ask you something," Rory says, gathering up his courage, because asking the doctor about physics is like asking to be hit in the face with a very sciencey lemon meringue pie. The doctor turns to him, ready to listen and answer, and Rory tries to inhale and explain what he means, but in the face of the doctor's patient curiosity, he's suddenly tongue-tied. "Yes," the doctor smiles, as if he already knows. "You start out a little slow, but once you get there all at once, don't you?" Rory bridles. I'm not slow. That wasn't an insult. The doctor startles him, laying a hand on his face and rubs his thumb along Rory's cheekbone. Breathe, he laughs. I'm not going to hurt you. Rory clenches his fists, gets control of himself, and waits for whatever the doctor's doing to be done. Oh, clever, gorgeous Rory, the doctor murmurs. Even if I don't understand what happened, not all the way, why do you think you have to? Rory watches him, wary. The doctor's lips curve. Because you like science, he says, and fitting pieces of the puzzle together, and you love Amy, and why shouldn't the universe revolve around her? Does it? Rory asks. The doctor lets his hand drop. I don't know, he says thoughtfully. It's a big cosmos. Anything is possible. That's what I want to know, Rory says, twiddling the hem of his pajama shirt nervously. The doctor touches his fingers, stilling him. Listen, he says, because this is not something I'll say often. When I say that I know something, it usually means I believe something and think I'm right. I don't actually know everything. I just make smart guesses. I can't answer you, Rory. I'm telling you, I don't know how a world without stars still produces Amy Pond. I don't know how any of that worked, except that I had a feeling it would. I hoped it would. He looks down at the console, still facing Rory, a hand still touching his knuckles. Disappointing, isn't it? When he was 10 years old, he dressed up in a raggedy old shirt and trousers and pretended to be the doctor, with a penlight decorated with glitter as his only defense against the mad, dangerous world outside. It turns out that's not really so different from the actual thing, the definitive article. The doctor might know more than they do, might be cleverer than they are, but he's not as omniscient as he seems to be. Rory twists his hand around suddenly to grip the doctor's wrist, tugs him close, and kisses him. Not because Amy loves him and he wants Amy to have everything she desires, but because Rory loves him too, and Rory wants the doctor to have everything he desires. The doctor jerks backwards, and Rory follows, still kissing him, until they collide sideways into a part of the railing. The doctor vaults over it, escaping. You! He shouts, pointing up at Rory from below, looking baffled and frustrated. You humans! Why do you have to go around kissing people all the time? It's really very upsetting! What kind of racket do you call this? Amy yells from the hallway. A second later, she appears in the door, blanket wrapped around her shoulders, hair mussed. Boys, are you fighting? This isn't what it looks like, the doctor blurts. Amy stares down at him, and then she sighs. Are we in a reality that doesn't exist again? She asks. Rory can't help but grin. That's his wife, that is. You're... infernal! The doctor gestures at his nose, which is kind of a sign language for Rory that he uses mainly when he's annoyed. He kissed me! Why do you people keep kissing me? Rory! Amy looks scandalized. Rory ducks his head. You could have waited for me! Sorry, sorry, he mutters in a very convincing display of contrition. When he glances up, the doctor is looking, if possible, even more confused than before. You're married, he points out. Honestly, the 21st century, I don't know why I bother. If I wanted to be snogged all the time, I'd find someone from the 51st. If I wanted to be left alone, there are loads of Victorians who wouldn't go near me. But it's this muddling up in the middle. You never know what you're going to get. First pond, and now... He makes the nose gesture again. Rory ignores it, because while the doctor's been ranting in his absolute best cranky old man style, Amy's been quietly descending the stairs from one direction, and Rory, catching her eye, has circled round from the other. My God, I mean, really, as if the libidos weren't enough, you're all sexually confused, and half the time, no one even knows who they want to shag. And you know who ends up getting caught in the middle so that it's somehow his fault? That's right, me. I get... Rory catches the doctor's shoulders from behind as Amy pushes him backwards. Amy's kissing him, hair falling over her shoulders, one hand holding his left wrist and the other keeping his face still. Rory's not really sure how much they can push before the doctor's head explodes or something, but he presses his face to the doctor's soft hair and kisses the nape of his neck. The doctor goes pliant against Rory, as if he's giving in to something he doesn't understand. But you're married, the doctor insists when Amy lets him go. So, Amy says. Rory wants to object to this, but he's busy essentially holding the doctor up, and Amy's much better at all this kind of talk anyway. That's the whole point of being married, the doctor roars, as if he's really stuck on the concept. You know, two of you, promising forever and everything. Rubbish, Rory declares. Amy beams at him. I thought, she says very carefully, like talking to a stray animal, it was about saying you loved someone. And the tax break. Tax breaks are important, Rory agrees. You're married. That means something. This is not okay, the doctor continues. But he hasn't tried to get away from Rory's arms around his waist or Amy's hands on his shoulders. It means we choose, Amy says. Together, right, Rory? Rory agrees against the doctor's neck. That is very distracting, the doctor announces, trying to twist around. Rory sometimes wonders if he's part cat. Alien cat. Whatever. He bends in ways people don't normally bend, which, in its own way, is very promising. Doctor, Amy says, soft and inexorable. Rory remembers when she finally accepted that Jeff was a fixture in their lives and promptly took him in wholesale. She's going to pull the doctor in like she pulled Jeff in, only this time the raggedy doctor game is real. What do you want? I want human beings to make sense, the doctor says forlornly. Sorry, mate, Rory tells him. Clearly, we're under-evolved. That's not fair. I never said... The doctor breaks off when Amy touches his cheek. His breath is coming short and fast. What do you want? Amy asks again. There's a perilous moment where everything seems to revolve on a sharp point. Dizzy, expectant. And then the doctor kisses Amy, kisses Rory's wife, and Rory pulls him back so he can kiss him too. Amy punches him in the arm and leaps on both of them so fast that Rory almost falls over. When they tumble into bed, finally, they laugh and wrestle, and there are a few minutes spent in sorting out some awkward elbows. Is he made of elbows? He seems to have more than the usual suddenly. There are kisses for the doctor and Amy's long legs twining with his, and Rory gets to touch everywhere. It's good. It's so good to have Amy and the doctor and to be Rory, to be alive. Turns out the doctor's bits are completely ordinary and there are no teeth or anything. They're actually very nice. Amy totally agrees with him. Afterward, with Amy resting her head on the doctor's shoulder and Rory half sprawled over his chest, within easy kissing distance of his wife, the doctor speaks first. "It's always a bit of a gamble," he says, in the soft, contemplative voice he doesn't use very often. "Sometimes I was just far too busy to bother, or I wasn't interested, or wouldn't be welcome if I was. It's been a long time," he adds, which makes Amy snort a giggle against his skin. Rory winks at her. "Are you happy?" Amy asks him. The doctor nods. "Rory?" "Oh, blissful," Rory says, and the doctor laughs. "Can I ask why?" the doctor inquires, shifting to sink a little deeper into the bed, as if he's staying a while. "I just don't... why?" "Well," Amy says, "Rory isn't happy unless he's got people to love. If he didn't have us, he'd be a crazy old cat man." "I don't like cats," Rory retorts. The doctor raises a hand to Rory's hair, stroking it against the grain. Rory reaches up and corrects him, and gets a swipe across his head, affectionate. "And you?" the doctor continues, turning to look at Amy. Rory is still a little afraid of his deep, searching eyes, but Amy isn't. "What makes you happy?" Amy smiles a secretive smile. "Adventures, new stories, my boys," she adds fondly. She reaches across the doctor to rest a hand on Rory's arm, and the doctor rubs his fingers against Rory's scalp. His chest would burst with pride and love. All the lifetimes he's lived, they were always knitted inextricably with Amy and the doctor. Now he has them, and they want him. Want him. "Where shall we go next?" the doctor asks, but he's not really looking for an answer. "The Dlod Reef? The 33rd century? You want to meet Beowulf? I'm warning you now, he was a complete tosser." Rory buries his head in the doctor's chest, grinning, while the doctor and Amy bicker about where they want to go. "Sunt omnes unum," he mumbles, feeling as if the last bit of the puzzle is in place. It doesn't matter to him, so long as he gets to go with them. The end.